Great. So thanks, everyone, for coming. Small but mighty audience. You're in for a real treat. This is a what this began, for me at least, as a YouTube video I saw right about last year at this time. And I write a blog about Second Life and a book about Second Life now. And so I usually get a machinima feed of stuff made in Second Life. And all of a sudden, I saw this strange, obscure video about someone named Molotov Alva. And it was just amazing. I had no idea who it was. And then I did some research, and I found out the creator was this guy named Douglas Gayton, who was an established filmmaker who worked with William Gibson and had a really impressive track record of kind of Hollywood multimedia stuff. And he had done this amazing thing in Second Life. And over the next few months, Boing Boing picked it up. And the YouTube video got just tremendous page views. And then all of a sudden, I find out that HBO is screening it. And they're going to be showing it. When is that, Douglas?
In May.
In May. So they're going to be showing it. But you guys get a screening right here. And let's take a look at it. I don't want to, you know, overplay it. Just take a look and think of the questions that you have. In pretty much anything, his film technique and kind of the industry side of how he was able to market what I think is the first big machinima deal to cross over into the big media. So do you want to say anything before the movie?
No.
All right. Let's just take a look and kill the lights. And
in January of 2007, a man named Molotov Alva disappeared from his California home. Recently, a series of video dispatches by a traveler of the same name have appeared within a popular online world called Second Life. What follows is his story.
What you're watching right now is a diary I've kept to explain how I ended up living in this online world and why I left my straight world life behind. Socrates said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." So how do I examine mine? Where do I start? Well, I had a house, a bed, people I loved, and people who loved me. But whatever connection I once had to that carbon-based world is now gone. The memories that tied me to that place are like some vestigial organ that stubbornly remains, a useless appendage that has been rendered by my evolution, by my being here, irrelevant. You can call it nostalgia, but I save these snapshots from my first life. Sometimes I return to this memory garden and wonder who these faces belong to, what they meant to the me I used to be. Because you see, I've been in my second life so long, I've forgotten. Which is why I've decided, before it's too late, to keep a diary, a digital record of my experience here, to remember who I once was in hopes of understanding what I eventually became. When I fell into the world from the heavens, I had less than nothing. Forget about clothes. I didn't even have skin. I soon discovered that in this brave new world, everything, from who I was to what I looked like, was changeable. I could be whoever I wanted, for a price. Did I want to be strong, tall, big, small, black, white, muscle-bound, perhaps older, or maybe a perfectly rendered digital facsimile of my carbon-based self? I decided that in this new world, at least who I was would remain constant, except for maybe a new set of clothes. And now that I was all dressed up, where in this brave new world did I want to go next? And so my life here began. I think it was Albert Einstein who said, "Reality is merely an illusion, albeit a persistent one." So if this new reality was an illusion, did its persistence depend upon me? To my eye, a city here was not a real city. A street was not a real street. Even walking wasn't really walking. This was a place where nothing was what it said it was. Even I was a fabrication. In this new world, I could stand on a beach, but could I taste the salt hanging in the breeze, feel the sand crunch beneath my feet, dip my toes in the water, and shiver from its coolness? All that I saw and experienced relied on memories I had from my other life. This place could only create an approximation of a beach. It was up to my mind to do the rest. But what would become of this place after my memories faded? After I could no longer remember the world I'd left behind? Without memories to give them shape, would this cheap facsimile of a city, this pixelated mountain, this digital palace be enough for me? Or was it that after my first life memories were gone, I would no longer miss what I'd lost? But then I realized the world I left was also composed of imitation objects. My leather sofa hadn't been real leather, nor was the non-dairy creamer in my coffee. Nearly everything in my old life was counterfeit, made to resemble something else. Why should this new place be any different? Real, virtual. In time, I could no longer tell the difference. I even came to believe that the builders here worked in symphony, together, subservient to some divine, invisible plan. But I was wrong. There was no rhyme or reason to this place, no uniting principle guiding the builders in their creation of our shared habitat. It was chaos, evolution gone haywire. Yet the haphazardness of these constructions somehow made sense. This was life in a virtual boomtown. As for me, how did I want to live? Within a city's protective walls? On a desolate beach? High up in the clouds? Because in this place, the land, the water, even the sky was for sale. So where did I ultimately reside? The answer wasn't that simple, especially since I now lived in a world where changing my address was as simple as deleting one life and clicking to install another. Which is to say, I moved. Often. Whenever the mood took me in my early restless days. As for furnishings, I had the finest designer objects one could own. But did I need all these things? Wasn't my life here becoming as cluttered with useless objects as the world I just left? Since I no longer needed sleep, did I need a bed? And since I didn't eat, my kitchen, my dining table, served no purpose either. Nor did I need an office. To be honest, everything in this house was ornamental, harmless, I told myself. Or was it? I suddenly realized something. The new home I created was dangerous. It was trying to make me nostalgic for the life I once had, the life I'd come here to escape. so I got rid of it. My life here needed to be different. But what did that mean? Maybe I needed friends. But could I find them here? Or was I to remain as alone in this world as in the one I just left? Of all the faces I remember from my early days, faces I was destined to never meet in the flesh, the one I remember most is Orhala Zanders. He was a traveler as penniless in this place as the one he just left. If what Aristodemus once said is true, that money makes the man, then what did a lack of money make you? Orhala had the answer.
I wish I could tell you that money grew on trees here, that whatever you wanted was free for the taking, that this place, because of its carefully considered design, left us free to pursue the luxury of doing absolutely nothing. But that isn't the case. Even here in this game of life we play, everything has a price, and that price can only be paid with money.
Orhala's words surprised me. Was I to be as bound to the wheel here as I'd been in my previous life? If that was the case, how could I stay? But then Orhala told me about his great vision.
If the minds who created this place, even down to hanging a moon in the night sky, had decided money was indeed a necessary evil, an inescapable part of the master plan, then money would have to exist anywhere else I went to. So I stayed. In the beginning, I thought it would be easy to live without money. I mean, what did I really need it for? Did I need a home? No. A cardboard box was enough. Did I need anything else for that matter? Couldn't I just be here?
And I agreed with Orhala. After all, isn't that what being here was all about? To transcend the material world? To reach a higher plane? Because the truth was, the daily rituals that made up my analog life now seemed so insignificant here. The only thing I owned was this digital recorder, the one used to make these images and tell my story. And with only that device, I too became a wanderer for a time. But with neither friends nor destination, the answers I sought remained hopelessly out of reach, which is why I ultimately ended up back where I started, with Orhala Zander, who from his throne explained the secrets he'd learned from a lifetime of seeking.
1. The seeker goes everywhere. 2. The seeker forever remains in motion. 3. The seeker tries everything once. 4. The seeker neither earns nor spends. And 5. The seeker only journeys with other seekers.
But if I followed these rules, where would they lead me? Orhala was quiet for a time and said,
"There's only one way to find out."
And that, my friends, is how the next part of my journey began. Wherever you went in those early days, you found interesting people. They were the true pioneers, travelers absolutely committed to life in this new world, and Orhala knew them all. Some of them reminded me of people who had slowly disappeared from my first life. What happened to us? We'd taken different paths, I guess. I moved. They moved. It happens. Still, we spoke by cell phone. We wrote emails. Aided by these technologies, my relationships became entirely virtual. Would making friends here in my second life be any different? If Robert Louis Stevenson once said, "Of what shall a man be proud if he is not proud of his friends?" then what had I to be proud of in this new world? Could I form deep, lasting friendships here, even if they were with people I was destined to never meet in the flesh? As it turns out, yes. And the first thing I learned was this: what you had been in the other place was absolutely irrelevant. Still, I sometimes wondered what happened to people in their other lives to make them leave and come here. Had they found their other existence empty? Had they come here to give meaning to lives that otherwise had none? Dee Dee was married in the straight world. She had a job at a mortgage company. Her first life was fine, she told me, but she never met anyone who was interested
in me. In this place, it's easy to make friends, have fun, and really get to know a person. Before, people never saw the real me, the one inside. Here, that's the first thing people connect with.
I asked Dee Dee if her avatar here looked much different than her other world self, and she showed me a picture. The two people looked nothing like each other, but what was I to say? Why shouldn't she get the do-over her other life had denied her and become the person she'd always imagined? Who was I to say it was wrong? Nor could I be judgmental about the people of a place called Caledon. They spent their entire new life in a world straight out of the 1800s, with gas lights and steam engines. It was an era where women were fine ladies, and men, proper gentlemen. These people weren't made for the 20th century, let alone the 21st. Being here allowed them to live in the world and time they were meant for. What was so bad about that? Wherever I went, I found people who'd reinvented the world to fit their own needs. It was an experiment in self-actualization, and the idea that you could actually be anything, build anything, was intoxicating. But Orhala wasn't convinced. He said,
"Everyone who comes here seeks the same truths they searched for in their previous lives. They keep their same beliefs. They pray to the same idols. They indulge in the same sci-fi fantasies. For them, being here has changed nothing. To live in a new world means to ask new questions, like who made this place and why. These answers can only come from seeking the Creator, from which all this evolved, and discovering his master plan."
Then Orhala asked,
"Will you join me?"
I said, "Yes, I will." And that's how I came to start my journey in search of the Creator. Orhala said only one traveler had ever met the Creator, Omar Plankton. Omar lived in the land of Gore, a fantasy world based on the novels of John Norman. In these books, men are masters, and women, they're willing slaves. These women had entered the same online world as me. They could be anything they wanted here, yet they willingly made themselves someone else's property. It made no sense. What about their freedom? According to a slave named Amber V, these women didn't want any. First of all, men and women
are not created equal. Our bodies are different. We have different emotions, different needs. We want to be celebrated for what we are and take our rightful place serving at our master's feet.
Orhala had a theory about Amber's choice.
Some people think they can come here and experience the real world without suffering real world consequences. They think they can live as if they're in a dream. But in the end, it's always the same. Because wherever you end up, people will still be people.
As for Omar, well, he had his slaves dance for us, but he had no idea where to find the creator, though he'd heard First Menlor knew. It turned out that First Menlor hadn't met the creator either. The First Men did tell us about the city of Nakama and Abigail Bright, which in turn led us to Sparrow Lowell. And while Sparrow had never actually met the creator of all things, she knew Pristine Barker and the Samurai Lords had. But entering the Samurai lands wasn't easy. It required passing ritual tests, including a bout with swords. It was only afterwards that we were able to meet Pristine Barker, who told us the story of her own search for the Creator. It was long ago, she said, after the
newness of this place wore off, I began wondering, in a world of infinite possibilities, who was I supposed to be? So I too began my search for the Creator. I entered one fantasy after another. They were as endless as people's incessant need to be someone or somewhere else. In the beginning, I transformed myself into a cyberpunk. Sadly, I found no answers about the creator. Then I became an anime character straight out of a Japanese cartoon. But even that brought me no closer to the truth. In the end, maybe out of desperation, I became an animal. I went to the land of Luskwood, where people had given up their corporeal selves to become animals, or what they called furries.
I didn't understand. Why would people do that? Pristine had the answer.
Historically, people have always been attracted to the purity of the animal ideal. Look at ancient Egypt and their animal gods. Or Native Americans with their totem poles. Even Aesop's fairy tales are totally anthropomorphic.
So what did you ultimately find in the land of the furries? I asked Pristine.
A unicorn. The leader of the furries. Ares Milkwood.
But even this enlightened traveler believed that no creator existed. That we were alone here. With each other. With our fantasies. And ultimately, with ourselves. So that's it? I asked. I mean, you never found the creator?
I'm afraid not. The creator may be out there. I have no idea where.
Afterwards, Orhala and I were without a lead, or even a path to follow. And as quickly as it started, our journey ended. A journey which had spanned the entire width and breadth of this entire new world. Now, it was over. And so a second journey began. One this time taken, deep within, myself. After my search for the creator ended, I decided that perhaps to live in the here and now would be enough. Even if I didn't know where here was, then the idea of now was practically meaningless. So I returned to the only place I'd called home. Yet even here, something was still missing. I had no one to share this new life with. I was alone. Would finding a mate be difficult in this new world? I decided to ask my old friend, Orhala Zander, but he was of no use at all.
Women are a lot of trouble,
he said.
And in the end, they'll eat you out of beans and marshmallows and leave you with nothing.
But I wasn't ready to be as cynical as Orhala. After all, if this new world was filled with seekers, there had to be someone out there searching for a person like me. Where had I met women in my first life? In bookstores. At the beach. And I guess, at times, I'd even gone to a club or two. But here, nothing seemed to work. out of desperation and maybe loneliness. I'll admit that I ventured into some unusual places. Unusual, even for me. And while I found temporary companionship, for the first time I was conscious about what it meant to be alone. Really alone. And then it, or I guess she, happened. Abigail and I had so much in common. It was like we could read each other's minds. And while there was no fireworks in the sky, and the seas did not part, I can honestly say it was love. Abigail showed me her second life, and I showed her mine. And together, we explored our new world. Finally, I showed her the house I built, which led inevitably to our problem. In this place, there was no easy way for us to express what we felt for each other. Intimacy seemed like an impossibility. How could we show each other what we really felt inside? We couldn't. Over time, we grew apart. So we went shopping. Abigail told me about something called pleasure balls. For in this new world, every intimate aspect of our daily lives required the use of customized computer programs. We needed special animation balls to embrace, to massage, even to make love. In the end, I almost managed to convince myself that despite our dependence on these awkward tools, we were happy, and that I'd found my soulmate at last. Which is why I was truly torn when he returned. Or Hollis said he'd found him.
I found the creator.
But I had a home now, a mate, a new life. How could I leave that behind? Abigail said I had to choose, and she was right. I could either complete my unfinished journey or remain here with her. It should have been a simple decision, but I needed time to think. There had to be something more in this new life, I decided. And then I remembered the words of T.S. Eliot. Home is where one starts from, he said. Well, if that was the case, this was my home. And from here, I would start. Goodbye. If something more was out there, we were going to find it. And thus, my final journey with Ohala began. On this, our final journey together, we walked and walked and walked. Time, the notion of day followed by night, had no meaning here, so I don't know how long we traveled. And even more troubling, the further we ventured from all we knew, the more I began to hear things in my head. For every thought I had, a multitude of strange new voices now rose up to provide commentary on the state of my journey. When I saw flowers, The voices gave me Edvard Munch.
From my rotting body,
flowers shall grow,
and I am in them, and that is eternity.
It didn't matter what I was looking at. I'd see a stone, and suddenly hear Henry David Thoreau.
The finest workers in stone
are not copper or steel tools,
but the gentle touches of air and water,
working at their leisure
with the liberal allowance of time.
As we continued our journey, I asked Rahala what these voices meant. Had I lost my mind? Or did finding the Creator require me to first let everything go, completely, so I could become one with the flow of data all around me? Rahala stopped, then said,
"Good. We're finally getting somewhere."
It was then that Rahala changed course. I can't tell you how I sensed it. I just did. After traveling to the edges of the known world, with one place blurring into the next, I felt our journey return to places we'd already seen and people we'd already met. Maybe Rahala was revisiting our past travels in search of something we'd overlooked. Maybe we'd met the Creator already and hadn't known, or hadn't yet been ready. Finally, my curiosity got the best of me. I asked Rahala if we were indeed backtracking.
"You said you wanted to meet the Creator. Seeing this hasn't been enough for you?"
"No, it hasn't," I replied. Rahala was upset, which maybe explained what happened next. Was this waterway the River Styx? Was this boatman delivering us to the other side Charon the ferryman? Did that mean all of us in this second life were already dead? That we'd given up living to come to this new world? Rahala wouldn't say. So we continued our pilgrimage to Tartarus in silence. Yet even this sacred place revealed nothing. The Creator was nowhere to be found. Perhaps Rahala had wearied of our adventure. Or maybe he no longer took our travel seriously. How else can I explain his next idea? To meet the knower of all things in this new world, a real oracle. Why hadn't Rahala told me about this before?
"Because it's difficult to speak to this oracle. First of all, you have to catch him."
The oracle was a chimp?
"Yes, and a rather speedy one at that."
The oracle lived amidst the haunted remains of an amusement park. His home, an abandoned funhouse. Never going to catch the oracle. It was impossible. But in the end, Rahala, as always, had a plan. And finally, I was able to ask, "Oracle, does the Creator exist?"
"Before I answer that, tell me, if you were to meet this Creator, what would you ask?"
There wasn't any single thing I needed to understand, except maybe to be sure that he or she or it existed.
"Would your life here mean any less if there were no one single Creator?"
"Yes, but somebody thought of it all. Somebody had to have put this all together."
"Why only one person? Why couldn't it be many people working on their own or working together for the same thing, for different things, in a world that reinvents itself daily?" And your only job here? To find your place within it.
Is that why Orhalik took me to all these places I've already seen? To show me that in this new world, everyone is the creator?
Ask him yourself.
But when I turned around, Orhalik was gone. And so was the Oracle. Was that it? Had I actually reached the end of my journey? This time I knew my answer. Since I'd chosen the Seeker's life, I, among many, was now on an infinite path, one without end, with my circuit joined to those around me. And in this new world, I too would one day become the Creator.
So thanks for watching. Just want to do a few questions and turn it over to the audience. Hopefully you have some questions of your own. So yeah, tell me about how this began.
I was approached in 2006 by a Dutch network, VPRO, to do a series of experimental documentaries. And at the time I was living in Sonoma on a farm, expecting my first child. And I couldn't actually... leave. I didn't really want to leave the farm to make this documentary. And then I heard about something called Second Life. And since I'd had a lot of experience doing films, using technology, shooting things off the web or creating digital stories, I was intrigued with the idea of actually trying to make a film inside of Second Life. And I showed it to the Dutch broadcaster and I explained to them that we were going to make something that was going to be short episodes that would be distributed over the web, an episodic documentary, and that we were going to do inside of Second Life. And so I spent like 6 months in Second Life without even really knowing how I was going to actually shoot it. I kind of put that part of it off. And just meeting people and documenting everything that I saw. And then I began the process of then making the film. It took me about 8 months total.
Mm-hmm. And it ended up on YouTube. Was that intentional or?
And then my Dutch producing partners, Submarine, somebody in the office put the first episode on YouTube, and after 3 days, I think it hit almost 500,000.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then what?
And then a week later, I was hired by MTV to work on their virtual projects. And then from there, a bidding war between MTV and Sundance and HBO led to HBO purchasing the film last year.
And this was all based on the YouTube.
It was all based upon that. I had the other episodes finished, but we, as soon as everything, we had ironically had always planned to distribute it over the web, but when everything kind of went completely, we weren't prepared for it to happen the way that it did, and to have broadcasters come to us. That was always our end goal, was to actually try to get an American broadcaster to purchase it. It happened within 3 days, so kind of subverted our whole web strategy for release.
Well, what do they make of this, and what do they see in terms of distribution, and you know?
Well, each of the networks, it was interesting to get a window into how networks look at broadband and how they look at cross-platform distribution, and to sit down with the big thinkers at each of those networks and to hear what their strategies were and what their plans were. Ultimately, ironically, I did the deal with HBO mainly because. I think every American documentary maker wants to do a deal with Sheila Nevins because she is the queen of American documentary. It really validates your work, and it would also, I thought, validate the medium of machinima.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the reasons why I went with HBO, knowing that they didn't really have a fully worked out digital strategy. Also, was intriguing to me. So that's been something that we've been developing jointly, and it's been really an interesting process.
Now, what was Sheila Nevins' take on this? Because
not even sure that Sheila owns a computer. I would be willing to bet that she probably doesn't. And one of the things that really, I think, intrigued her, though she's obviously spoken about it, is one of the things that really intrigued her was that she had never had She'd never seen anything that explained the internet or specifically a virtual world to her. And I think that's been one of the interesting things about this project is that most people won't go into a virtual world, but that doesn't mean that they're not curious about it. And so I think the film, in a way, explains some of the experiences or that you might have or the values of the people that are inside those worlds.
So this had nothing to do with, oh, there's Second Life has a big, big media buzz and we want to jump on it kind of deal?
No, I think really it's just, you know, I think, historically, you know, people who make documentaries, I don't want to say that they live outside of time, but there is the need to kind of document things in a way that can stand up to the test of time. And I think that one of the things that really attracted HBO was that nobody had ever done something like this before. And that they wanted to make a statement that they were embracing this new medium.
How much time do we have? Oh, 15. Okay, we're good. So yeah, you're saying it's a documentary. So in what sense is it a documentary? Let's go through that.
Well, you know, obviously it's provocative to call anything made inside of Second Life a documentary. Its premiere was at the biggest documentary festival in the world, Hot Docs. And when I first screened it to a room full of very rabid documentary makers, somebody stood up and said, how dare you call that a documentary? What makes it a documentary? And my response to him was, this is the same response I would give now, is that because it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And to the best of my ability, I made one decision at the very outset, which is I wanted to make a film inside of Second Life without ever leaving Second Life. I thought it'd be very, very trite to show somebody and then show them that this person actually is a grocery clerk in Des Moines, Iowa. And I thought that there was probably going to be 10 people who were going to make that documentary, so I didn't need to make that documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to confine myself entirely to trying to tell that story without ever leaving Second Life. And so that was the first rule that I gave myself. The second rule was that I was going to document it, and I was going to really try to collaborate with the people that I was documenting. So, and every step along the way, when I was making the documentary, as I would shoot things and write things, I would always give it back to the people I was documenting so that it was entirely accurate. I don't think that anybody's in it would say that it's not an accurate reflection of our experience together. Orhal Azanda, this hobo, is a person I've never met in real life. And yet, he's the person that basically has been my guide in Second Life since I first came in there. And I tried to explain our relationship as accurately as possible.
I'm just curious, how many Second Life users are there out here? Okay, well, about half. That's probably good. Because mm-hmm. he covers kind of all the main subcultures in a very seamless way. So that's something that Orhala kind of walked you through.
Right. It was, you know, Orhala, who has, I think, one of the largest groups in Second Life. He has 200 and something people as part of his hobo community. Basically, the hobo community from the very, very outset became intimately involved in what I was doing and were constantly introducing me to people once they realized what I was trying to do. And so things like, for example, that whole section about the samurais, where I actually had to learn how to actually sword fight because of this whole this one area inside
Samurai Island,
where you actually it was a total combat island, and yet I really wanted to get to know these people, and the only way they would actually let me in is I actually had to prove myself to them. But this happened time and time again, and it also happens in the community of furries, where you have to really prove yourself to be accepted in, and you know for good reason. They have created these communities that are closed for a reason, because they want to be among people that are like-minded.
So let's just talk a little bit about the technical, the way you were capturing the video. Did you use Fraps or any of these traditional machinima tools?
Well, when I began, I obviously did research about all the different techniques you could use, and there was a number for people that use PCs. There's a program called Fraps. For people who use Macintoshes, there's a number of other programs. I tried them all, and I really wasn't really satisfied with the results. I ultimately, in my frustration, and it was deep frustration, I ultimately spoke to a friend of mine who makes films over at Disney, and he asked me how big my computer monitor was, and I said it was 23 inches, and he asked me if it was an LCD, and I said it was, and he said, "That's really, really simple. You're just going to point a video camera at the screen." And so I had a DV camera,
uh-huh.
And it was, you know, I think it's called a prosumer DV camera. And I pointed it at the screen and digitized it. And I was so terrified because I'd already taken the money from the broadcaster. I had to deliver this thing. I was so terrified that I just decided if it was semi-broadcast quality in the camera, then coming out, it should be semi-broadcast quality. But I never did a check after that. I never burned a DVD to look at it in the monitor until literally after I'd mastered the audio, laid in the titles, and finally burned a DVD. And my editor said, at some point, we got to look at this on a TV. And at that point, I looked at it on a TV. And what was amazing is that that's what HBO bought. And there was a thing in the contract with HBO that was all about broadcast specs. And it was about 5 pages long. And it was terrifying because I said, well, this is when I'm going to be shown. This is when they're going to finally look behind the curtain and it's not going to be broadcast legal. And we bumped it to HD and we bumped it to 35 for a few festivals. And it actually looked kind of beautiful in 35 because it got kind of warm and kind of fuzzy. It didn't have sharpness to it. So that was my experience in terms of actually the production of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It has a very different texture than all the other machinima I've seen in Second Life, certainly, because it's this raw capture.
The other thing is that I finished shooting this over a year ago. I finished shooting this in January of 07. And for a number of reasons that are too boring to get into, but spoken about the way that TV networks work, it's only being aired now. I shot, there's a whole bunch more that's going to be appearing on the web. And I'll get into that, the multi-platform strategy in a second. I shot 30 more minutes. And let's say that my filmmaking abilities are infinitely more sophisticated now than they were when I made this. The video is all stuttery because it was on a cable modem on a farm with a very bad internet connection. I didn't know that you could get a really high frame. I didn't know any of these things. And I was on a really kind of lame computer with a very slow CPU. I didn't know that would affect things. I was very, very ignorant. So now you can get, super high frame rates, almost 30 frames per second. You can get super sharp images. And I actually had to dumb down all of the new footage that I shot to match this because otherwise they wouldn't cut together,
Well, let's circle back to the topic, which is your machinima ready for Hollywood? There's a lot of potential, I think, in machinima as a filmmaker's tool, something you could use. But what advice would you give people who want to try that and try to go Hollywood?
Well, I think that I've heard from a number of different people at agencies and at the network level and some studio people that they really want to see what happens with Molotov. They really want to see how it works on HBO and on Cinemax, and they want to see what the general public's response to it is. And the reality is that you can make a broadcast quality animated production inside of a virtual world. So I think that was one of the points of Molotov, is that getting a network to buy it was a big thing. I think that it's an incredibly flexible platform. Speaking about Second Life, it's incredibly economical. You can make an entire film for nothing inside of it, and it's just simply limited by your imagination. And I think that more and more people are going to be creating things like that. I think it's not entirely impossible to say that there'll be a feature film within a year that's made using the same processes.
Well, I want to touch a little bit on the rights. As probably most of you know, Second Life, the content creators, each individual user retains the underlying IP rights. So technically, you would have to, I think, have to ask the permission of everyone whose content is there, whether it's a building or clothing or whatever. But how did HBO approach that?
Well, so the laws for documentary making are a little bit different for narrative filmmaking. There are a number of fair use laws that apply to documentary films. And however, having said that, when I really featured something, either a person or I really featured a set or an area in Second Life, I would go to the person who made that and I would explain to them what I was doing and I would get a release. But for the most part, I was counseled by HBO that wasn't really necessary.
Yeah.
And I have to say that this is a process I went through with the legal minds at three different networks. I'm extremely intimate with the laws that pertain to shooting in Second Life.
And are they all comfortable with that Second Life platform as far as legal questions?
Yeah, I think they are. But again, I think that that's another whole other area that I think is that Molotov will be a test case for. Sadly, we've been putting together a book based upon this, and I would say probably 9 out of 10 of the locations that are in the documentary don't exist anymore. So that's another thing about Second Life is that it's a very impermanent medium too.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of intellectual property law, I think it's going to, I think we haven't even begun to ask even, we don't even know how to ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
But I spent months and months on the legal side vetting all the different things. And but we even did that knowing that we were ill-equipped to know what will come.
You're setting a precedent for the whole kind
of. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, just as it was provocative to call it a documentary and to get HBO and different documentary festivals behind that, I think it's also the idea of intellectual property rights and virtual worlds that are created by their inhabitants is also another interesting thing to look at. And I think that I think it's going to be a great conversation.
Yeah, definitely. And we should have a conversation with the audience. Anyone have some questions? Want to throw them on out? Seifert? Yep. Embellishing, let's say. He's wondering how much the documentary is.
In Second Life, you can fly and you can teleport and, you have a screen filled with all these interface boxes and inventory boxes. But I was thinking of a general audience that, I'll put it this way. I was sitting, with, I won't say who it was at a prominent network. He was lecturing me on what my film was, and he was whenever I would say something, he'd put his hand up and then explain to me what I was about to say. And he finally said, "Listen, you just need to understand. I know everything about animation. I could even tell you how long it took to render all that." And I went, "Okay."
Cool.
Except that it wasn't rendered. It's all happening in real time. And so you have to think that, you know, you are so intimate with Second Life that you have a very specific relationship with it. The general public doesn't even know that this is just a world that's completely billing, you know, coming to in real time and streaming in real time. So the gulf between your experience level of Second Life and the general public's is so great that I wanted to make it as simple and universal as possible. You know? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the first part.
Ethical dilemmas.
Oh, ethical dilemmas. Yeah, ethical dilemmas. Well, it was a big deal, and he's written. You've written about this. It's a big deal, like in the community of gore. While it's very tempting to. Because you could see it in a very kind of perversely funny way that people want to be slaves and they want to be subjugated and they want to be paraded around in chains. It's actually not really a game to those people. And so you have to be like incredibly – I had to be incredibly careful because to not make it look like anybody was being mocked. The same thing that you would see that where people are – you know, enjoy mocking furries. People, for them, it's very, very serious. And it was interesting to go to a Second Life conference and show some scenes from this last summer and meet a lot of furries and people from Gore. So I try to be very, very respectful of these people. I actually, after everything that they told me and how they told me how they wanted their experience to be explained, I would send them the stuff. I would then record the audio, give them the audio files because I really wanted them. The last thing in the world I wanted was people who had opened up themselves to me to feel like they had been completely taken advantage of, you know.
Go ahead.
I use Skype and I would talk to the people that I had, that I wanted to film, and I would have them use Skype, because in Second Life, otherwise you were, at that time, there wasn't voice in Second Life. You'd have to be typing and see your hands going like that. So we would use Skype. And I mean, from a purely technical standpoint, I had three computers, one computer that only ran Skype, one computer that just ran Second Life, the camera, let's say, the one computer that just ran Molotov. And but there has been times when I've had six computers, four of them with Second Life opened up four times in the same computer, you know. Right. Yeah. I never thought of that before, but that's an interesting observation. Did you ever have issues with I'll to answer that question, I'll say that one of the most fascinating things about shooting inside of a virtual world is that it's so much like the real world that it's amazing, in the sense that you have weather problems, you have crowd problems. Where people just won't leave, or if they realize you're shooting, they just won't leave, and they do anything to disrupt what you're doing. And so
there's even mobs, so you have to deal with
with people, because what happened is, if by the end, like, for example, in the recent episodes that I've been doing, it's become this thing where people now, if they see Molotov, they shoot an image of him and then they post it on Flickr, or they make a little video, and people are starting to do these Molotov sightings, which became difficult to shoot Molotov. Because sometimes I would be shooting, all of a sudden there'd be like 10 people there. They'd be constantly teleporting all around wherever I was shooting. So it became crazy.
Where in the world is Molotov?
Right.
Well, you had a question? Yeah.
No, it was exactly the same. There's no difference. I guess the only difference would be that because we were so ignorant, we didn't understand frame rates, and now everything we do is at almost, let's say, at least 20 frames per second. So you can cut footage. But back then, frame rates were so different between shots that sometimes it would just be kind of weird. So that was the only issue, is just matching the frame rates between shots.
I guess having the camera, too, sets up that context of kind of the jerky footage, because it's documentary, sort of Blair Witchy sort of
Yeah,
thing.
I mean, I actually did figure out a way to kind of make things look handheld towards the end, but I really thought that... to kind of get back to what I was saying to you, I kind of wanted this to be so straightforward and dumb simple that I want to take all of the arty elements out of it, you know.
Any questions? Oh, yep. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Except they would know that you hadn't. Well, there's a couple of reasons the way Second Life works. One is they could actually have a list of who's allowed in the area. So therefore, you would try to teleport in, but you can't get in, because it just wouldn't let you in. You'd have to know somebody in the group that puts you on a list that allows you into it. If you create an area of land in Second Life, and Second Life is different. Second Life is different than any other virtual, because it's actually, if you rent or buy a piece of land there, you decide everything that happens there. You decide that. You decide who can come in and who can't come in. And so you would have to gain the trust of these people in order to be allowed in. You have to meet them, honestly, in a neutral location where you'd have to explain what you were doing, where I'd have to put things up on the web for them to look at. I'd have to give them things, and then you would be allowed in. But in the case of the Samurai, even once I got in, I had to go through all of these other, you know, things.
The Samurai Islands, it's got, I think, a couple thousand people playing it, and they're really hardcore. There's like different dojos, and they compete against each other. So if you break the rules, they'll kick you out. So you're going to,
Well, except that I would take exception with something you just said, because I'm not sure I agree with you. The creator's not Linden Labs. the company that makes Second Life, because they just make the underlying code base. The creators are the people. That's the point of the film. The people of Second Life are the creators of everything you see is made by the people of Second Life. And so I think that is what makes it. That's the interesting philosophical issue that I realized, not when I started out, but towards the end, I realized that's actually what it is. You know?
So let's go to another question. We got anything else? I don't want to make it solely about Second Life. Let's talk about other platforms, other worlds, because you know the World of Warcraft, of course, is the biggest one, and there's some other ones. What are the potentials of making films and marketing them, getting financing in other MMOs?
So the next project I'm doing is a feature-length film, Molotov's journeys into a number of other worlds. My background is I've done stints in video game companies, obviously with virtual worlds. And so what I really want to do is take Molotov across everything from Habbo Hotel to Gaia to World of Warcraft through Halo. And again, using Molotov as a kind of a way to explain what are the values or the user experiences in these places. Because again, while everybody knows that Halo did $163 million in its first week, probably one person out of 10,000 can tell you even remotely what the story's about. And yet that doesn't mean that people aren't interested, because they probably are curious. I think that Molotov, by going through all these different environments, will be able to kind of explain it to the general culture. So each of them will have their own problems in terms of how do you film inside of them, but that's also the challenge that I like from a technical standpoint.
But also, you not only have to get funding from a financing entity like a studio, but you would have to get Halo, Microsoft's permission. How do you do that?
Well, that's a long process that I'm still involved in, but I think, as I've explained to you, I think that Machinima.com has really kind of educated me on how this works, and Alan Debevoise, who's the CEO of Machinima.com, has worked very, very closely with Bungie, who makes Halo, with the other publishers. Blizzard does World of Warcraft. And they're beginning, these companies are beginning to see the value of films happening inside of their platforms, extending the universe of their stories. And so whereas they would be very protective of their IP maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I think when they see how Molotov explains Second Life in a way that doesn't take away or detract from Second Life, they're going to see the value for their platforms as well.
So you've had these conversations
ongoing. I haven't had Blizzard yet, but they're all ongoing, and I have a feeling that I think that they're not going to be as hard as I thought. You know, Guy and Habbo, I've already worked out how to do that. It's mainly for me. It's not really that issue because It's not really that issue. The issue is the technical level. How do you shoot something interesting inside a place like Habbo, for example?
So if a straight up filmmaker is talking and say, well, look, I like this Machinima idea as a platform, but what do I do? Where should I go? I mean, and they want to make a film as opposed to just, you know, a kind of game tribute or something. What are you saying?
Well, first of all, you know, everything always begins and ends with the story. So it has to be a good story. And secondly, so the first thing is always story. It just has to be a good story. Secondly, is it has to be technically of a certain level. I think this, I'm not sure this is ultimately an indication of that. Certainly the stuff I'm doing now in Machinima is definitely broadcast legal. And that was always a concern that people had. But the main problem that has historically been the case with Machinima is that it's mainly been done by people who are video gamers that just are screen capturing their video game. And it's not really the same as storytelling. So that's the big issue. And I think that as more and more filmmakers begin to see the power of making films with these tools, there's going to be more and more really great stories, and the medium is going to evolve in a really rapid pace.
Well, and you said you were with Propaganda Films?
Propaganda Films.
And that, tell the people what directors are associated with them.
Well, Propaganda Films is a company that was started in the 90s, and it was me, David Fincher, Spike Jonze, Michael Bay, Antoine Fuqua, David Lynch.
Yeah, so I mean, have they seen the film?
Well, a few of them are actually, Bay, for example, on Transformers, on the second Transformers, they're actually looking at this as a previs tool. But you know, there's Cameron as well. I mean, when you begin to work in this platform, see how incredibly fast it is to build build something. It's just an incredibly powerful previsualization tool. So
definitely almost like a 3D storyboarding process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of them unauthorized, but others not. Any other questions?
I haven't really thought about it. I felt that I had such a tremendous burden on this first one. I had two goals for myself in my first film. One was that I wanted to get a network to actually buy it. That was my goal. And I wanted to make a documentary and I wanted to have it be seen as a documentary, regardless of all of the issues that would arise out of that. The goal for the second film is that I want to get a studio to buy it. That's just my goal. So even having been approached by networks that want to be involved in the second one, I'm just not even talking about that. I just want to see if you can make a film that comes out of these virtual worlds and social network platforms. And so that's like the goal that I have for myself. Whether it's a documentary, yes, it's a documentary. I mean, but I'm no longer belabored by what a documentary is anymore.
Well, it's interesting because...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a French filmmaker who nobody's heard of, but his name is Chris Marker, who makes films that are basically La Jete and Sans Soleil and Letters from Siberia. But his films are basically personal meditations on something. And, when they put them on the shelf, they're put in the documentary area because where else do you put them, you know? So, and he, in interviews I read with him, he's never really been worried about the classification.
This is a documentary about a person that doesn't exist, basically.
Who? I'm sorry, Molotov doesn't exist?
Right. Or is
I would argue that he most definitely exists. I mean, well, he sort of does exist.
A transcendent version of yours.
Molotov has had a series of experiences that I haven't had. Molotov has built a life based upon a series of experiences and relationships that I have had third hand. So I would most definitely argue. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting things about the contract negotiations with MTV and HBO was that Molotov is distinctly defined as being not me. But okay. when Time Magazine did a piece about this project in September, they never even mentioned my name. They only were interested in talking about Molotov. So,
does Molotov have an agent or
UTA?
He does, and he's registered as
Molotov. Is represented by UTA.
Excellent. I think you can get some work out of him.
Well, hopefully it'll be my meal ticket.
Cool. Any other questions? Oh, yeah.
Because I realized, again, in making the document, I realized immediately the incredibly crystal clear distinction that people made between who they were and who their avatar was. To the point where people would go to a Second Life conference with a business card. They had their business card of, this is my business card. Then they had their Second Life business card. Because people have really created identities for themselves. Many people, multiple identities within Second Life. And I really realized from the very, very beginning that the idea that we now have digital selves that exist within social networks and virtual worlds that at times represent aspects of ourselves, but not our total self, that are in a way distinct from ourselves, is one of the main things that define what your experience is in a virtual world. And because I really wanted my broadcasting partners to understand that, I actually had to put into it so that we really understood what we were talking about. All of the press for this project, for example, all interviews with Molotov will happen within Second Life.
Oh, really?
I cannot speak for Molotov Alpha.
Who's going to speak for Molotov Alpha?
Molotov will speak for himself in Second Life. You have to go into Second Life, and you'll be able to interview Molotov Alpha. And it was something that the press team at HBO and at Cinemax really understood immediately, because they understand that for this to really shift people's kind of consciousness about what a virtual world is and what your relationship is to a virtual world, you have to really make that fundamental assumption that you are not your avatar.
So this is a pretty big conceptual shift for big media companies. How did you talk to them about that, or did they?
Yeah, because but it was from our very first conversations when we talked about Molotov, because they kept on wanting to understand how much of this was Molotov's story, you know, and they wanted to talk to Molotov, all these things. So I had them go into Second Life.
You were talking with the HBO folks and stuff, like Sheila Nevins or whoever.
Well, not Sheila, because Sheila.
Her assistant.
I'm pretty
assistant,
certain that Sheila's never been.
Her assistant's kid or something.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So that was the first negotiations?
No. The first negotiation was they were given a copy of the DVD, and within 7 days we were doing a deal. But when we began to really talk about what it was, when we began to talk about how it's being released, because it's going to be released. It's 10 episodes. The first 6 episodes, which is under an hour, will be released on television. And then to see the entire thing, I've got them to agree to take the rest of it and put it on the web and put it on video on demand and other places. So it's really going to be a multi-platform release, because it's our experiment to see how people come to it. Some people might come to it off of a blog and just see all the episodes from there ending up on TV. Other people might come from TV onto the web. So it's an experiment that they're doing to see how distribution can work. Well, from a
physiological,
there's issue of the skinning of how you skin something, and so we're dealing with that right now. But we have people designing like the Hubble version of him right now and things like that,
cool.
And the Gaia version of him. Well, I'd have to work directly with them and actually probably sit a blizzard and actually skin them with them.
Like what they did in South Park, that episode. Yeah. I think we're way over, but hopefully Douglas will hang around and take any questions. I'll be happy to talk to anybody. But thanks, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.
See you at some of these parties.